CliffCentral.com. Okay, I hope your Thursday's off to a good start this morning. We have lots to talk about. Canthan Pillay's on his way in. Here he is. Good morning, sir.
Welcome, Canthan.
Why have you stolen my seat?
I'm repossessed.
Because this one's not work, it's a long story. So grab yourself a seat. We'll organize you some coffee. And if you are ready for the burning platform, then we are too.
You've been dispossessed so much of this particular land.
Yeah.
Expropriation without compensation is so real.
It's happening, whether you like it or not, Canthan.
Touches every one of us.
All right, so. It's been another quiet week. There's really nothing to talk about. This is going to last all of 2 minutes. You know how South Africa is. Boring, boring, boring in 2019.
He brought a folder. He brought a folder.
A folder. CliffCentral.com, just after 7, which means on a Thursday we get to do the burning platform brought to you by Nando's. Cover all the most important subjects of the week so that when you bump into anyone who thinks they know what's going on, you don't have to feel like you're the only one in the room who doesn't. That's all. You can footstewards take Canthan or Pumi's ideas and pretend they were yours.
We've got 400 people who'll be gathered tonight who don't have a clue what's going on.
Who are those 400 people?
State of the Nation address.
Oh, those people.
Yeah.
It's tonight. I can never remember. It used to be during the day during Thabo Mbeki's time, remember?
Yes, yeah. And then Jacob Zuma changed it to the evening because, well, for a couple of reasons.
Well, didn't he have a whole lot of sex arranged for the daytime?
Well, I don't think
he... Or is it that criminals don't like to be seen at night?
No, actually, the reason was that there's a higher television audience in the evening, purportedly. So, yes. You know, he preempts interesting things like Generations and puts in place the State of the Nation address. Yeah. You know, how absurd. You know, Generations brings this country together. Well, it used to at any rate. Does it still put
Now it's Isibaya.
That's right.
I have no idea what this is.
President Ramaphosa's second State of the Nation address. He will deliver the budget for this year's SONA.
Might well be his last.
Yes, exactly. The cost of the SONA this year, 2.5 million rand.
That sounds a bit cheap.
It sounds cheap,
It's cheap,
it?
But it is not including all the outfits that our revolting parliamentarians will be wearing.
Look, I doubt it includes the cost of the security that the city of Cape Town needs to lay down for this thing every year. Not that I have a problem with the city of Cape Town paying the security because they can afford it.
Also because they get private security.
But I doubt it's 2.5 million. But that figure sounds like a complete thumbsuck.
I think considering the amounts that we've heard Bosasa have been dealing with, 2.5 million is nothing. It's a drop in the ocean.
It's sitting in someone's safe, actually.
Yeah, correct. Or in a Louis Vuitton bag. Kasatu's chief expectation from the SONA is job creation. Kasatu also wants the president to pay serious attention to state-owned entities. Who doesn't, frankly? And I heard Kasatu say something interesting since we've brought them up. Since I brought them up so early in the discussion, Kasatu said the ANC should seriously consider striking from the party list anyone implicated in corruption. Now, implicated.
But then
people,
they don't have a party list.
This is the point. People get very sensitive there. They go like, oh, you can't, you know, consider someone guilty before they've been proven guilty. But this is not an allegation of guilt. All it means is you have to sit out the election this year. You're not allowed on the party list. I don't think that would be a bad thing. And if there's any whiff of impropriety in your dealings, maybe that's a good way to go. Kasatu said it, not me. And Kasatu form a big part of what the ANC's backbone of support is.
Yeah,
right?
I feel sympathy for Kasatu's platform, but the issue that I've got is that it fails a test of constitutionality. We do have this unfortunate thing in our country where we presume innocence.
But we're not sending someone to jail.
Well, yes.
You're not allowed on the list.
Yes, but what you are doing is you're working on the assumption that there's a hint of impropriety. And the difficulty that I have that opens up an entire can of worms in that anyone can actually make an allegation of impropriety in any walk of life.
Yeah.
And you suddenly rip society to shreds.
And it will lead to political shenanigans where people will accuse people of things.
Exactly. So that's why I'm such a stickler for rule of law, even though our laws are badly applied. I think we can all agree about that. Pumi's put on her glasses.
This is getting very serious. All right, so let's talk about the, since we're on to Kasatu, the Trade Union Federation.
I just want to be able to see you, Canthan, please.
They say that a philosophical speech won't save and create jobs in South Africa, and we can't afford to see 37% unemployment rise even further. Kasatu spokesperson Matthew Parks says They are cautiously optimistic that Ramaphosa can deliver on some of these issues if he's given time.
Well,
are you optimistic, you two?
Well, at very least, if you consider that just in the past few days, we've had a situation where Lindiwe Sisulu has single-handedly managed to piss off an entire contingent of people who were actually on our side in June of last year by rushing in where angels fear to tread. And you have the ANC issuing this totally outrageous Venezuelan-like statement about the imperialist forces of the West marshalling against Africa.
And it turns out that the presidency had already dealt with the letter. They'd received it. They'd said thank you. It was in the light of that whole investment.
But it wasn't a letter to the presidency.
It was a memo.
It was a memo that they used for discussion notes when they were meeting with South African business people, including the CEO of Standard Bank.
My God.
So it was never a diplomatic communication at all. And the Sunday Times, you know, the most appalling tabloid journalism still continues to pour
fake
out of that
news
cesspool.
Sunday Times.
Goodness, you know, what a cesspool that publication is.
That when I saw that headline, the only thing I thought of is I hope they have shown us a picture of this letter, because the credibility of the Sunday Times is already shot to shit. And now look at this big claim, and they're putting it on their front page with their huge masthead, and then it turns out all of it was not even a storm in a teacup.
It's very, look, we could talk about the Sunday Times in a minute, because I think that does merit some discussion. But this whole Lindiwe Sisulu situation, explain it as if I'd never heard the actual story is. And explain why what she's done is so egregious.
Well, essentially what happened was last year, shortly after Cyril came into power, he called business leaders on side and said, look, we want to raise $100 billion in investment over the next, 5-year period, I think it was, 5 to 10 years, I forget,
yeah.
$100 billion US dollars in new investment coming into South Africa. Mm-hmm. And as part of that, there was major business leaders in this country were briefed to engage with a range of foreign governments, including those that were named in that letter. And as part of the process, when those people were meeting with the likes of the Standard Bank CEO, they had drafted a list of points for discussion. And among those points for discussion were some of the things that were raised in that memo. But at no point did they actually mention things like corruption and graft specifically, but rather raised points of governance as points of concern that would need to be overcome in order for them to be able to persuade investors on their side
right.
to come to South Africa.
So it's fairly obvious what those things would be.
Yes.
You know?
And so it was notes that they put down for themselves to bring up as part of that discussion, which they had with the business leaders as well as with ANC people at the time. So this was in the middle of last year. And now Sunday Times suddenly treated it as though it was something new, and as though it had breached diplomatic protocol, and splashed it on the front page.
And then Durko didn't do the responsible thing.
They didn't actually check what's going on.
They didn't fact check.
Yes. If they had fact checked, then they would have realized, no, hang on a second, actually the Sunday Times screwed up here big time. So Durko went rushing in with guns blazing. And then, of course, there's the party itself, which then turns around and issues the statement. And basically what it tells all of these investors, you know, ahead of when Cyril is trying to go in and persuade the world tonight that we're actually responsible citizens.
We're not a banana republic.
And in fact, Durko shows exactly the contrary.
Yeah. Well, this is very, very bad. So Lindiwe has something to answer for. Do you think that she's going to be hauled over the coals for this? Do you think
nobody gets hauled over
by
the coals?
So in other words, we'll steadily march towards banana republicanism.
Oh no, we've been there for a while now, I think.
And okay. Considering
but
that
that's okay.
Has
we still
legacy.
Love our country, don't we, guys?
And considering that Lindiwe has a legacy name as Sisulu.
Yeah, she can get away with murder.
She's one of the nobles.
Yeah, that's right.
The ANC.
Yeah, she's in our aristocracy.
With a huge constituency of her own. I mean, she did look after the military vets. It's very difficult to bring her to book.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, especially when you're so precarious as young Cyril is in that position.
So on that matter, Cyril has to face the nation tonight, but the South African Business Confidence Index fell in January. Business confidence was mostly stable, investors seeing progress in economic and political reform as a stalling, while activity in the real economy remains sluggish. The Chamber of Commerce and Industry had their monthly business confidence index, and it slipped to 95.1 from 95.2, which is not a huge drop. While the monthly reading barely changed, what we measure is the 4.6 index points that it has slipped by compared to the same time last year, when sentiment was lifted by two and a half year high by incoming President Cyril Ramaphosa's promise of an economic turnaround. Well, he's been there for a year, and we're not seeing the things that we wanted to see, that we were all hopeful for.
There was a promise that he was going to create how many thousand jobs?
I think it was 250,000 or something.
Yes, and he's created, the economy has added about 3,000, I think.
New dawn.
Yes.
New dawn, guys.
But, Canthan, let's just go to basic principles here. Governments can't create jobs.
Exactly. Now,
this is something we need to be very honest about.
How many of you guys actually took in Trump's State of the Union address?
No.
Okay, the reason why I was here at exactly 7 a.m. this morning is because I was busy going through Trump's State of the Union address.
Mm-hmm.
And the fascinating thing about going through the State of the Union address, where Trump is just basically ticking off a series of achievements that the American economy has achieved over the past period, well, since his last State of the Union address. Just in January alone, the U.S. economy added 304,000 jobs. Employment levels at the U.S. are the highest they've ever been in the history of the country, particularly employment levels for minorities. The majority of people who were taken into new jobs, 58% of the new jobs have come from women. Employment levels among African Americans have never been as high. Employment levels among Hispanic Americans have never been as high. In other words, what he's done by basically putting in place deregulation, he's allowed the economy to flourish and people have become employed. And real wages have been rising for the first time in more than a decade.
If he was a Democrat, people would be celebrating.
Yes, but Democrats would never have done that because Democrats believe in more government and not actually reducing the size of government. Now, if you try turning around to Ramaphosa and saying what you actually need to do is get government out of the way, get rid of the laws that don't allow us to hire and fire as we see fit, and just allow people to actually pay whatever
let them decide. I accept this wage or I don't.
Yes. And the economy actually flourishes.
That's better than sitting around waiting for a social grant.
But the thing is, we've seen this process happen through the course of history over and over again. Yeah. Margaret Thatcher did it back in the late 70s, early 80s. Ronald Reagan did exactly the same thing. Bill Clinton did exactly the same thing during his time. And the economy actually flourished. And really all you need government to do
is move.
Just get out of the way. Stop all of the stupid regulation that you've got. I mean, Kossatu wants more jobs and higher paid workers. The thing that the idiots in Kossatu don't realize is that because you've actually got a shrinking workforce, their power base has been cut by what?
Kossatu's never been weaker. Yes, First of all, because other breakaway unions have taken away lots of support, but also the number of people employed has dropped. Therefore,
that's exactly right.
The number of people who can join a trade union has dropped.
Yes.
I mean, they don't represent the unemployed.
In fact, what they need to do is they first need to take the brakes off the economy, allow as many people as possible to get employed, and then start a fresh recruitment drive. That's how you actually build a power
base. But how about the argument against that? That, oh, but there's abusive workers, and oh, there's capitalist voraciousness, and it's unfair, and people be exploited, and we've got a history in this country.
Oh, trust me, you know, I've risen to the upper echelons of business in this country, and the biggest abuse takes place on the boardroom. Trust me, been there, done that, and you have to give as good as you get. It's the nature of the beast. Business is a competitive environment. We need alpha people actually in those boardrooms that are actually driving growth. You know, you don't get growth by being touchy-feely. You get growth by being aggressive. And Trump has proved this thing. Guys, really, go to whitehouse.gov. Mm-hmm. Just read through the text of his
It's remiss of me to... Look, I have to say that part of me has... and this is an aside completely from our discussion, but a part of me has abdicated from politics in some ways just because it doesn't fulfill me in any way like it used to. It used to be interesting. It used to be the kind of stuff I want to talk about. I'm less and less enchanted by politics, not more and more. So I have to force myself to read these things. And usually when I do, I find it quite gratifying. But I have to say that the overall sentiment of politics in the world at the moment, and particularly our local politics, does not engage me the way that it used to. Am I the only one?
You know, the thing that's the major difference from what you see, what Canton's talking about with Trump and what we are seeing, and I saw this tweet from the presidency yesterday and I thought, hey, about hope merchants, which is very similar to the kind of speech that he gave last year where he was saying, let's all do this to Mamina. I'm here for you to send. Is there's so much... talking in our state of the nations, it's all about plans and hopes and mm-hmm. dreams, whereas this is about what has been done. And I read an article in the New York Times a week ago about the problem with Africa being there's just too much hope here. We don't need any more hope. We just need to be working. We need to be getting things going. But isn't this part of the problem? For in the state of the nation is I'm not looking for more hope. I'm not looking for more plans. I am looking for more concrete kind of
delivery.
Are doing this. Let us do this. This is what we have done in the past 12 months. And this is what that has resulted in. And we're not going to get that.
This is such an important point because I think for a lot of people, you know, they're tired of these platitudes and they're tired of being told that things are going to get better or that there's some kind of promise or that the state's going to save you. It's going to swoop in like a godparent and lift you up out of misery and poverty and the difficulties that we have in South Africa.
A fairy godparent, absolutely. Not a godparent.
But if we look at what's been delivered, and Jacob Zuma got very touchy last week when someone said to him, oh, well, it's 9 wasted years. Cyril mentioned that in a speech. 9 wasted years. And when you dig, there isn't a huge amount that we can be proud of in the last 9 years. I mean, he was really grasping at straws when he said, oh, well, you know, AZT, and even there, it's been kind of a lackluster delivery in terms of AZT. There are many more people who could have been saved.
Well, the fact
Let's
is
not
that
forget that the reason
AZT's efficacy has tanked, basically, because what's happened is that you've had HIV strains that are now resistant
because people haven't taken their drugs all the time consistently.
Exactly.
But my point is, we wouldn't have an AZT success if we hadn't had a Thabo Mbeki AZT failure to begin with.
Well, actually,
if we had started looking after
and
people.
Let me debunk that myth conclusively once and for all, because whatever you may say about Thabo Mbeki, during his time, the 80 supposed research centers that were set up around the country that were dispensing antiretrovirals collectively distributed more antiretrovirals than the rest of Africa put together. This was under Thabo Mbeki's time, starting under Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma and then moving to Manto Shabalala Msema.
So why does he have the reputation then of being this AIDS denialist?
You know, I really get so tired of actually seeing that, because ultimately what happens is what was the immediate effect on the ground. And the fact of the matter is that if you look at the reason why AZT is no longer effective, it's because of the fact that if you are on ARVs, and let's be very clear, ARVs work, but they actually require mental discipline because they stuff up your system. Because essentially, they're poisons.
They're a bunch of poisons.
They're a bunch of poisons, but they're poisons that are meant to actually target HIV. And if you are the type of person who actually realizes that you have to discipline yourself to go through the physical agony of being on ARVs until such time as your viral load and your immunity levels get to where they need to be, it means that if you're not actually eating properly, not sleeping properly, not actually tolerating the pain, and if you go off the drugs, HIV mutates and it suddenly becomes resistant.
And much more virulent.
And that means that all of the drugs that you've developed up to that point become ineffective because you haven't done behavior modification. Which is one of the things that Helen Ziller was talking about.
So what I'm hearing about here is that actually this isn't something we should be laying at the feet of government at all. It's individuals who are not disciplined enough to give themselves the care and attention
this
that they need
to make
correct.
It through. This is absolutely correct. Which is a point that Helen Ziller was making back in the day. And, you know, she got a smackdown for that, for saying that people should take responsibility for their own actions. But the fact is, if you see your actions in that situation impact on, it's like the anti-vaxxers. Mm. You know, if you have one person who decides to be an anti-vaxxer, you can actually devastate an entire population.
Suddenly polio's back and measles and all kinds of things.
But all of that rubbish.
What that is also about, Gareth, which the individual responsibility, which is my favorite thing.
Yes.
It's going to be my platform when I become a political party. But the individual responsibility is also about us as the citizens who listen to the news and see. It's not just about what we see and hear. It's really, we are so far removed. So you and I, Gareth, sit here in the studio, we read our newspapers, we see what's on Twitter. But because we are so far removed from what's happening actually on the ground, we only hear a particular narrative that's being pushed by whoever is pushing that narrative. We don't know what the real on the ground experience is. For those people who are going to clinics, it's like when I was telling you about the trains and Binaspurt, right? For those people who take the train, they see what they see. And all we hear is we only hear the boardroom banter. We only hear the abuse that's happening at the executive level.
Right.
Because that's all we are willing to expose ourselves to. That's all we're willing to expose ourselves to. And that's the thing about South Africans is we've got to, just again, with the example with Sunday Times, for those people who only saw that headline, who only read that and haven't understood what happens on the other side or what has happened on the other side, all they know is that, oh my God, all these countries think that Cyril Ramaphosa must do something. And it's not even true.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, listen, fake news. Another thing we tend to attribute to Donald Trump, but it's been going on for years. And now publications, I mean, I see Iqbal Serv last week had to explain himself to one of our commissions of inquiry.
Did he do so? I missed that.
No, of course he didn't. No, of course he didn't. He obfuscated as much as you'd expect him to.
Okay.
So that lovely PIC money?
Did he actually appear, though?
So, I'm just fascinated by this whole ARV thing because I didn't realize that under Thabo Mbeki there were 80 centers that were dispensing as much as they were in terms of antiretrovirals. And I feel like we've been apportioning blame to the wrong person. I certainly have. So it's a bit of a mea culpa and a sense of individual responsibility for me that I need to correct something, that I was totally misled about how bad Thabo Mbeki was and even Manto Shabalala Msimang, because we believed the headlines.
Yes.
And sometimes those headlines come from fake news outlets that are irresponsible. Well,
lazy journalism fundamentally is what actually affects us. One of the things that became a problem, you know, back in my early days as a journalist, and we were basically poor, all right? Let's be very clear.
All journalists are always poor. Good ones are.
Yes, but
unless you're paid by Bosasa.
What would happen is that immediately at the point at which you started earning well, then your lifestyle would actually change. So instead of spending time among the dregs of humanity that you had come from, you were suddenly spending time, you know, having drinks in the better bars. You were driving a car as opposed to making use of public transport.
Yeah.
And your view on the world changes so drastically as a direct result of that. And the situation that we have right now is most of the commentary that actually filters into our consciousness comes from people who are relatively affluent. Mm. And they actually do not end up in a situation where they're aware of what it's like, for example, to stand at a queue in a public hospital that's dispensing ARVs.
My God, and that's before we start out politicking each other over red wine and Twitter.
Exactly. Exactly. And I'm not sure of the answer of how we actually get to the point, other than to actually empower people who are on the ground to tell their own stories in a way that's kind of structured where we're able to filter it. I don't know how we get there, though.
Let's try to answer those questions over a period of weeks, because they're not the kind of things we're going to figure out instantaneously.
But well, if you provided us alcohol, we would.
Yeah, you see, I mean, maybe that's the solution. Maybe we should give journalists free access to alcohol, and perhaps they'd be a little more scrupulous.
Free access to alcohol would not solve what Canton is talking about. We need them in the bars in the townships.
Yeah.
In the shebeens.
Well, we need them talking to real people. But I think, you know, journalists have come under a lot of unfair and sometimes very fair criticism because we expect them to be almost superhuman a lot of the time too. And And they can't be. They're also, like all the rest of us, subjective in respect of a lot of things. They might be economically subjective, as Canton's alluded to. They might be people who are politically or ideologically subjective. So these things
Although,
are going
to
happen.
Although, to be fair, the one thing that technology has provided us with, and access to relatively good but cheap technology, is that it has allowed people on the ground to be able to tell their own stories in various ways.
It's and simply to find the way information that, from varying sources.
It's simply the way that we filter it out. So one of the reasons I still have a lot of the information and connections that I have is because I still have to drive home to my mother's house in the township every, you know, so I still have friends that are sitting in those places. I still have family in rural areas. So I still have an everyday connection to it, as it were. But a lot of South Africans sit here and we like to think that where we are, you know, that Joburg is the epicenter of the world in South Africa, but it is actually not. It's not Cape Town and Joburg. There's a lot more happening on the ground. And when it comes to the good things that are happening in the country, and we still, you know, I remember a time when at my aunt's house there was no water, there was no electricity. Today she's got a tap, she's got electricity in the furthest regions of KwaZulu. You know, you have access to data, you have access to the internet. And what all of that does is it democratizes the opportunity to have agency, to have the agency to tell our story. And that's what young people do for us, is we see it on Twitter every now and again, it pops up. In terms of the stories that young people, we would not know what is happening at DUT if it was not for the fact that the kids have their own cell phones and they're filming all of that and they're putting it out on Twitter, and we're seeing it with the, you know, with the hashtags that they put up. It's not a, and that is the opportunity that we all have. And this is the thing that I say every week, is that each and every single one of us is part of making this new way. We can't just sit back and say, oh, I'm just going to listen to the news and hear what they have to say.
No,
be
sure.
Part of it.
And in fact, it's not worse than it's ever been. It's exactly the same. There were fake news merchants before, and there are going to be fake news merchants ahead of us. Mm. And we've got to be able to find sources. And thank God for the internet. Now you can find innumerable varied sources of every kind and description. If but you're just prepared to look for it.
We've got to be willing to be comfortable in the discomfort that what we might see, what we might hear,
might not support our narrative.
Is not what we hoped it would be. Mm-hmm. But understanding that if we don't know what it is, then you can't change it.
Let's talk about the PIC board. You saw that they all resigned en masse last week and sent a letter to Tito Mboweni, who's now looking at appointing a new one. And Bantu Holomisa has said that Finance Minister Tito Mboweni needs to act decisively to bring stability to the PIC. Why are the PIC important? Well, because they control R1 trillion or more of other people's money.
Well, it's a third of our national debt.
So this is a lot of money, and these guys are probably the biggest investment unit in South Africa. And they've been on the take. There's been corruption and scandal and all kinds of things. There's a commission of inquiry specially called to look into the PIC. And this board have resigned. First of all, what does it mean that the board has resigned? Does that mean that they are all trying to run for the hills? Does it mean that
Does
it mean they're responsible and they need to clear out of the way so that they can do investigations into the rest of it? Or is there something else afoot?
Most notable that the chairperson,
Mondli Gungubele,
who is the deputy finance minister, has also resigned. So, like, he's not resigned from being the deputy
finance minister,
but he's resigning from one aspect of his actual everyday job. What the hell is going on there?
And isn't Deputy Finance Minister a big enough job for you to not have another job?
But no, so it's an oversight role. So in his role as Deputy Finance Minister, he automatically becomes the chairperson of board. So what he's essentially done is he's saying, I don't want to do this part of my job anymore. I still want my job, but I don't want to do this part of my job anymore.
Canton, help us understand this.
Let's just talk about the PIC first and foremost. The PIC for the longest time has been treated by people in power in this country as a sort of piggy bank. Mm-hmm. And essentially it is the money that is meant to guarantee the pensions of public service workers. Right. Now, interestingly enough, we also have another entity that does something very similar, and it is called the Government Employees Pension Service, which provides pensions for the likes of members of parliament and for people actually in power. So there's one set of rules that gets applied to the money that is required for the future of the masses, and there's another set of rules that actually applies for people who are sitting in parliament. Hmm. So the PIC has been able to make appallingly bad investments that are never going to pay any sort of return, because this is money that actually belongs to the masses, and, you know, as usual, politicians are very happy to play with it as they see fit. While the Government Employees Pension Fund has shown steady growth over the period. And my take on this very simply is the way in which you fix this mess right now, you need to merge those two. Take the Government Employees Pension Fund, you take the PIC, pull them both together so that the future of parliamentarians is as affected by those bad decisions as the future of the masses. And that's how you're going to fix it immediately. Right now, there is no way that all of the people who work for the public service can actually hold the board to account for essentially what is their future.
Can that? But you speak about the bad decisions that the PIC makes, and earlier we were talking about the narratives that get pushed at us in particular ways. I'm particularly fascinated by the fact that there's so much noise being made about the PIC bailing out Edcon, right? And I'm going, that's such a bad idea, guys. That's such a very bad idea. But there's so much noise being made in that respect. And everybody seems to think that that's the right thing that the PIC should be doing on the one hand. And on the other hand, we're like, but these guys make such bad decisions. And, you know, everybody's money that's being... It's such the schizophrenic approach that South African media pushes at us, and South Africans then buy into a particular narrative, and then we're like 12,000 jobs at Edcon that are going to be lost, not thinking about the fact that if the PIC does bail out Edcon, what it's actually doing is it's jeopardizing all those hardworking nurses and doctors and teachers.
And they're kicking the can down the road because Edcon might fail anyway despite the new cash injection. They will. So Bantu Holomisa makes a good point. If you're going to be making investment decisions, you shouldn't be a politician. Politicians don't know how to invest. They're not the right people to entrust to this. You should employ asset managers. You should find ways of deploying this into the public sector, because the public sector has a pretty good rate of return on these investments. And it's certainly been better than the JSE's delivered in the last year or so. I mean, what do you think of that?
Who's going to bell the cat?
Okay. Well, what do you mean by that? Common sense
is it's from the story that you learn when you're a kid. You know, the mice hold a meeting and they say the cat is coming around all the time and is picking us off one by one. And you know, how do we solve this? And then someone puts up their hand and says, "I've got a great idea. Why don't we tie a bell around the cat's neck so that when the cat is coming, we can hear the cat and we can get out of the way?" And everyone says, "Yay, fantastic, let's do this." And eventually someone puts up their hand and says, "Who is going to tie this bell around the cat's neck?"
Yeah, so that's the problem we've got.
Yes.
That's exactly right. So Bantu Holomisa makes a good point, though. He says, this thing of saying it's a secret, we're totally against that because this is where money is stolen. He also said, you need to screen the people you're going to appoint there, and I hope we're not going to be given another list of ANC carders to go and run the PIC. Well, ANC carders have proven themselves to be completely effete and incompetent at just about any place they've been deployed.
But who in our political has proven themselves to not be that?
No, but this is my point, right? If we actually had to deploy people on the basis of merit, God forbid we should be successful. Well, again, who will bell the cat?
Like Bantu's not, I mean, as much as he's been making all of this noise around the PIC, even he doesn't stand up to that kind of scrutiny. He's sitting there with his own political party and it hasn't changed leadership in how many years?
That's also true. No, that's exactly right. He points out hypocrisy, Pumi. How easy to do with politicians. All right, can we talk about the EFF's manifesto?
Did anyone read it? It was exciting, though, to watch the stadium fill up on Saturday. Come on, Kenton, what do you think of the manifesto?
You watched the stadium fill up on Saturday. What was I doing on Saturday? I'm trying to remember now.
Anything but watching the stadium fill up.
Yeah, but because I already had a copy. I think, Gareth, I sent you a copy of the 170-page.
What is this boys' club? Why am I left out of this boys' club? Guys...
because no, you're not part of the WhatsApp group. It's not because you're not a boy, but it's because of the fact you never signed up.
Only boys are in that WhatsApp group.
No,
but anyway, tell us what you think of the manifesto.
Yeah, what's the gist?
The gist is that we're making all of these outrageous promises where we're going to give you all sorts of strange and wonderful things. And we can afford to do that because we're never going to get into power and we're never going to be held accountable for these things. So in the meanwhile, we can promise as much as we want. And there are lots of people who are extremely gullible who are actually going to believe us. And at the point that they do, they're going to give us a vote, which ensures that at least we'll have people in parliament this year. So it's very easy to lie and make promises, but they're promises that can never be delivered. You know, they do all sorts of interesting calculations where they say, if you take this money that would otherwise have been spent on corruption and then put it into doing the following things, then we can actually afford to do all of this. But consider that they want to do things like, firstly, they want to take away all property rights. Then they want to allocate houses to you mm-hmm. that they are then going to be paying for or subsidizing. Or
and guess who will be allocated the best houses? I'm thinking the EFF leadership.
Although, Canton, the whole point of a manifesto, as it's been in this country, is it's all about promises. It's all about promises, and most of them are pie in the sky. What could they have done differently?
Nobody reads manifestos. Nobody actually gives a flying.
Yeah, that's why Julius, you know, has a big dinner the night before and invites journalists and they drink fancy wine.
Yes.
And then has a big stadium full of people to pontificate to. But the whole point of manifestos in this country is that it's all pie in the sky, whether it's the ANC's manifesto. And one day when we see the DA's manifesto, we'll also wonder about that. You know, it's all just pie in the sky. What do you think should be done differently then?
If they can't
just make promises and we hope that the promises that they're making they can deliver on.
I don't want promises. I want principles that people abide by. And if we can get to the point where we have principles rather than promises. Mm-hmm. If people say, for example, I stand for property rights and I'm not going to budge on this, there's no compromise. Because property rights is one of those things like pregnancy. You either are or you aren't.
But the whole of South Africa has a set of principles in our constitution.
Yes, but I'm saying that political parties don't stick to principles right now. So does the DA stand for affirmative action or not? Well, it depends on who you ask on whatever day. Does the DA stand for freedom of speech or not? Again, it
they
depends.
They can't even talk to each other.
Yes.
They have to talk to each other through Twitter.
Yes. Does Ramaphosa support expropriation without compensation? Yes or no? Well, it depends on which day you ask him and which audience he happens to be speaking to and what language he happens to be using at that particular time.
Correct.
Including rather poor isiZulu, as you point out to us all the time, Pumi.
So if we talk
in terms of manifesto guy, principles, you know, I really would like people to just say, I stand for the following things, well, and you should vote for me on that basis.
I'm going to pull a quote out of there, and you can comment on it afterwards, because it seems to me that there is a mushing up and a mixing up of principles here. He says, this is Julius, a Agretsi must be arrested. He is not our friend. He is a thief and a racist. But just because he's a racist doesn't mean we should not listen to him. Agretsi must continue revealing those who benefited in corrupt dealings. So
yeah, we'll listen to him while he's in jail.
Yeah. So I don't know what Julius wants here. Like, he's speaking with forked tongue. Then he says, that thief called Jacob Zuma must be arrested and taken to jail. Didn't he just the other day say we must forgive him?
Yeah, he'd found deliverance.
That's right.
In a church somewhere.
There are
not Shepherd Bushiri's
church. But guys,
again,
we're talking about what Julius said as opposed to what's in the manifesto.
So. Sure, but I think what Julius said, you know, they should be congruent. You would hope.
One would hope.
So he says, thereafter we're going to go to Gwede Mantashe. Then we're going for Nomvula Mokonyane, who is eating stolen frozen chicken. We're going for them one by one.
They're going for the chickens one by one.
That's what I'm thinking.
Stop it.
No, seriously, the stuff that gets said on those platforms, they're meant to basically, you know, get the crowd all enthusiastic, which is why it comes back to, you know, the point around a manifesto. No one, you know, apart from Roman Kabanak, is going to read through a 170-page manifesto. Roman has read through it, and he's been tweeting salient points from it, and I'm very grateful for him for doing so, because he is a lawyer, and that way I can actually avoid needing to do it myself, which would otherwise be painful. But I would take the trouble to read through the EFF's manifesto if there was the slightest possibility that they would get into power. Now, they're not going to get into power in the next election. Are they going to hold the balance of power to a large extent? Yes, I think so. But ultimately, their ability to effect change in our country is not going to depend as much on them as much as the extent to which the ANC is willing to waver on particular points of principle in order to cling to power. And we've seen the ANC has done that, Nelson Mandela Bay being a key example of how that actually works. Mm-hmm. The shenanigans that are still going on in terms of the Tshwane Metro right now, that is where the threat is going to come from. It's not going to come from the EFF's manifesto. It's going to come from the fact that the ANC are a bunch of corrupt bastards and they will do whatever they need to do to stay in power.
As we're trying to navigate the political waters of how we're going to vote in the next couple of months, weeks actually, all we have available to us is what we are reading, what we are hearing, what we are seeing, right? And from what I'm hearing and reading and seeing, the hope that everybody has that the ANC is going to dwindle tremendously at the poll looks less and less likely. I mean, the EFF is coming out. I mean, they are from the analysts, from people calling this document of theirs dishonest, downright dishonest, to you saying it's all pie in the sky, they'll never get the place, the opportunity to do this. The DA, on the one hand, we're still waiting to hear what they're saying. They can't even agree on what they think should happen, and they can't talk to each other. So I don't know if that's going to ever be forthcoming. What were we talking about? Inkatha. Right, Inkatha and what are they saying to us right now? Bantu Olomisa and his party. I mean, all of those parties are eating themselves up. On the one hand, we're saying the ANC is a bunch of corrupt losers, right? But everybody else is not a viable option either. Is not a viable option either. So as we are sitting here trying to navigate who you are going to vote for, this big hope that the ANC is going to dwindle tremendously, I don't see it coming. I think the ANC is still going to be by a very large margin.
Well, I agree with you completely. And the reason why I agree with you is that I think in terms of sheer numbers, the ANC will go down because the number of people who are going to vote is going to go down in this election. But having said that as well, the number of people who are going to vote for the other parties is going to go down as well. So you're still going to have a stay away from the elections, and in that stay away scenario, because nobody is going to be inspired enough to go out and actually vote, it means that the ANC is going to emerge the winner. And they are going to have a majority.
With a good number. Because that's the flaw of democracy.
Yeah.
It's not about who should have voted. It's about who votes.
I doubt they will do as well as they did last time around. But they're still going to have a majority. I'm very clear about that.
Supra Mahumapelo, Pumi showed me a video of him celebrating. Of course, he has got to be reinstated within 2 days of that ruling. Johannesburg High Court found yesterday the decision by the governing ANC's National Executive Committee to disband the Northwest Provincial Executive Committee, which was chaired by Supra Mahumapelo, was procedurally unfair and a breach of the party's constitution and in violation of the applicant's Section 19 constitutional rights. He, along with other disgruntled ANC members, was seeking to have the ANC National Executive Committee's decision set aside. That's what they achieved, and man, did he celebrate.
Yes, that's brilliant. And I think what he needs to now follow up with doing is that he must actually cause some disruption in that province. Recall the government, appoint a new premier, just, you know, cause chaos, yes.
But so what does this mean for the party? You know, so on the one hand, I mean, they have a couple of these court cases coming to sitting. What does this kind of ruling actually mean for what's come out of Nasrec to begin with, but also going forward in terms of Cyril and his power bases?
His singular power base.
Seriously. Because this ruling, besides the fact that it gives Supra all his power back, You know, is it also then emboldens some people in their various corners with all of, and what when you when
the old
parties,
Premier League Ace and Supra and
it emboldens Cora. People because sure. that's what court judgments do.
Now here's a hypothetical scenario.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we have elections. The ANC wins by a comfortable margin. Let's say anywhere between 55 to 58% of the poll, so that you know they automatically get to elect the president. But if you look,
I think
in,
they'll get more than 60.
It doesn't matter. The numbers don't matter. But what is? I think we can all agree that they'll get a majority, and that's what matters.
Sure.
So let's not quibble the numbers. You get to the point where they've won the elections and they've got a comfortable majority, so they can nominate and elect the president. Now, if you drill down into the party lists and ask yourself how many of the people on the party lists are still from Zuma's faction and how many of them are not. And if you have a situation where a majority of them are in fact actually from Zuma's faction, let's say on the first day when Parliament actually gathers under the Chief Justice to actually elect the president of the country, and someone stands forward and puts up the name of Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma. What happens? Based on the fact that if you look at the ANC parliamentary list right now, that could be a very real scenario.
And then she would be president.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I have no reason to think that that is not a real scenario based on the party list that we've got. So now if you want to then tie in with what's happening with the ANC as a whole. Right now, nobody's taking sides in this entire conflict. So if you look in terms of what's happening at the upper echelons, people are stepping back. They're not shooting their mouths off because they're not sure which way this tide is going to flow. So we spoke about this a couple of weeks ago, the likes of, you know, Zweli Mkhize, for example, who, you know, commands a substantial support base in KZN, but he hasn't committed himself to a particular course of action yet. Which direction is he actually going to blow in? Is it, you know, because Jacob Zuma has been there campaigning just to show that he's still that force on the ground. So what's going on within the ANC? Well, I'm still...
Oh, because, yeah. this morning, Zapiro cartoon in the Daily Maverick, which says a lot of what you're saying, has Cyril Ramaphosa standing at the podium with shadow state of the nation, but looming over him is a shadow of Jacob Zuma, kind of overshadowing Cyril and the podium and the entire... So, ooh, that would be lit. I would love to see that scenario play itself out.
My God. All right. Busy, busy stuff.
Well, here's something that I got from an ANC WhatsApp group, and I'm going to tell you about it very quickly, okay? And I'm just going to
Which
read
ANC
from it.
WhatsApp group, Jacobs?
No.
Okay,
you know,
okay.
We don't provide further information on this. So I once asked a friend of mine somewhere in June this year if he didn't think that that Didi was JZ's successor and if Vladimir Putin had nothing to do with the Nazareth outcome. And my observation was confusing. My reason for believing this is simple. JZ and his global allies know the rules of the game. For example, the Russians aren't stupid. They are not going to abandon their friend JZ in a hole. They are aware that South Africa is too small to withstand global economic sabotage from London should NDZ win. A much better strategy had to be devised to avoid such a calamity and to save the ANC. The conference had to be won by CR, but the key posts of SG and Deputy SG had to be preserved. And it goes on.
So it sounds like conspiracy upon conspiracy.
Conspiracy upon conspiracy. And the fact is, guys within the ANC ranks are talking about this stuff all the time. Yeah, and they keep kicking it back and forth between them in terms of what's actually going on. Because...
Well, has anyone even seen Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma for the last year? She's been... Where's she? Like, has anyone seen her? It's like Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Is she even alive?
Yes, she is. Ruth is alive. She's tweeting.
Is she?
Didn't we see her at a funeral a couple of weeks ago?
Ruth Bader Ginsburg made her first public appearance yesterday.
Oh, thank God. She's not dead because they were looking for signs of life. There was a hashtag.
Yeah, she's very much there.
And in Nkosazana, do we know if she's alive?
I have no reason to doubt. I think that she's a survivor, that one.
So I like the issue around global economics because I'm always fascinated at the pivotal role that South Africa has, small as we are, far as we are, in terms of keeping the balances of world economics also at power, and how that plays out in South Africa. A couple of days ago, there was that thing about the currency manipulation with Standard Chartered, right? Yeah. I'm like, why can't we just be left in peace to, you know, carry on as we are carrying on, whether our currency, why is everybody so interested in South Africa the way that they are?
I don't know that they are.
What? Why then? No. Why then is it within the interest of a Standard Charter to manipulate our currency?
Because
why
it's then manipulable. I don't think it's going. That's pure solipsism.
That's exactly the point.
It's pure solipsism. Yeah. We think we're important. Honestly, that we make up what 1% of the world, the global economy, even less, I suppose. Now, we're not important. Nobody's interested in our story anymore. Nobody's actually paying attention. Most people in educated places in the rest of the world, we're a curiosity, that's all. And I think that there are probably specialists in universities who deal with like South African studies or whatever, but it's almost like, you know, the anthropology department. They kind of sit there and do their thing. We're not as important in the world as we think we are. Most people don't even know where South Africa is on a map, and it's in the name.
But there is the opportunity to make lots of money in the very short term by playing the forex markets.
Sure. And this currency is the best one to play with.
Yes, because of the fact that you can actually manipulate the currency based on spreading fake news. And if you do that effectively, you can clean up a large amount of money in a relatively short space of time, particularly if you have access to inside information. And there's, you know, fairly credible evidence that shows that every time there was likely to be something that was going to be affecting the currency, you had the likes of the Guptas who were actually able to profit from shorting the rand at that particular point.
Because they knew what was going to happen.
Yes. So...
So the apathy of South Africans, it means more and more that the apathy of us as South Africans is the only thing that we have within our power to change our future. No one is going to change it for us, and we can't be apathetic about it. We can't sit back and hope changes.
I mean, Pumi, really, look how dumb we are. We were taken for a ride by the Guptas. If they hadn't landed at Watercliff for that wedding, we still wouldn't know they existed. Most people don't know what parastatal contracts are going where. This family, those three brothers, took us to the tune of, what do they say, 100 billion rand or 150 billion rand or something. It's just unbelievable how stupid we are and how easily manipulable we are, not just by the Guptas or by Jacob Zuma, but also by the international markets. We're completely at the back of the line when it comes to being smart enough about how to handle ourselves.
But it all comes back to one thing, and the question of apathy is not in terms of the fact that we don't want to do anything, but the only way we can do it is by changing the government. And I think right now we can see that
it's
our opportunity, it's not going to happen, because there is no one out there who is actually saying we stand on the following principles. I'm still waiting for Musi to actually say something more substantial than One South Africa.
Don't hold your breath. Apparently the DA is rocked by allegations at the moment that the Institute of Race Relations is trying to influence them, which is precisely what a think tank tries to do.
Exactly.
Why is that revelationary? I mean, who's...
But that's the gauntlet that's being thrown, guys, is one that says they are not going to do it. We have to do it.
To my point, we're so puerile and so basic in terms of our understanding of the part. Yes, we are. That's why we have the poor choices we do. There aren't any available choices that can get us out of a situation where we're victims of either the government or the global financial markets or our own stupidity. There aren't better options for us. And so it kind of leaves you in a position where, even if you are the kind of person that I know you are, Pumi, who believes in accountability and in, you know, having a point of view and not being apathetic, so what?
There's another way, guys. We have to make it happen.
You're starting that party, Pumi.
You need to. You need to. Canton's right. You should have started it weeks ago.
I'm too old to start a political party now. There's lots
too
of young
old.
People. Yes.
The only people you can vote for at the moment are old.
The average age in Africa, average age across the whole continent is like 14 and a half years old.
And what is the average age of a leader in Africa?
Young people must get up. Young people must get up and be counted. You know what they must fight for it.
Do you know what the average age of a president on this continent is? 75.
it's gone down since Mugabe's been removed. It was a little bit higher.
It was a bit higher. But doesn't that tell you the whole story? 14 is the average age of the citizen.
Yes, but that's the thing is this, is while we sit back and hope that some elder is going to lead us into, we need a new way. We need to get up and, what did you say last week? Get up and stand up. We need to do it. That's what young people must do. We need to make the change instead of fighting against each other.
Well,
we
guys,
need to find a way to work with each other to make the world a better place.
I can see we're running out of time, but if there's a single appeal I'd like to send out to all of us ahead of the State of the Nation address today, download a copy of Trump's speech and then compare it tomorrow with what Cyril Ramaphosa says tonight.
All right.
And let's just draw some lessons from the difference between the fact that the American economy has never looked as good as it does right now. It's been creating jobs, wages are up, all of those things. And let's just see what Trump has done that has led to that scenario and compare that with the stuff that is being proposed by Ramaphosa tonight.
I like it. Just on that note, it's worth playing a small extract from Trump's speech in which he talks about socialism, something which is very much an ongoing topic of discussion in human affairs. People like to talk about this stuff inordinately. I posted it on my Instagram, but for your edification, I will play it here again. It's kind of funny because it's Donald Trump talking about socialism, and then what happens is they pan across after the applause to a lonely, sad, miserable-looking Bernie Sanders, who's sitting there sullen and dejected, and the music from Curb Your Enthusiasm starts to play in the background. I do like this.
We are alarmed by the new calls to adopt socialism in our country. America was founded on liberty and independence, and not government coercion, domination, and control. We are born free, and we will stay free.
Oh, that's brilliant. Love it.
And Bernie's sitting there, miserably all alone. It's so sad. All right, so there we are. That's the Burning Platform today. It's brought to you by Nando's. Thank you very much for joining us. On the way, we're going to speak to Skulk Besaidenhout and spend some time talking to him. He's a brilliant, talented man who's got lots of interesting points of view. He's very, very funny. He's doing so well at the moment. Sold out shows everywhere. We're going to talk to him about his career so far and some of the stories around it. Pumi, Canton, thank you very much. Thank you for joining us for the Burning Platform. On the way, some Skulk Besaidenhout just for you. CliffCentral.com.